This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Last Book in the Universe by Rodman Philbrick. Chapter 1. They call me Spaz. If you're reading this, it must be 1,000 years from now, because nobody around here reads anymore. Why bother when you can just probe it? Put all the images and excitement right inside your brain and let it rip. There are all kinds of mind probes. Trendies, shooters, sexpos, whatever you want to experience. Shooters are violent, and trendies are about living in Eden. And sexpos, well, you can guess what sexpos are about. They say probing is better than anything. I wouldn't know because I've got this serious medical condition that means I'm allergic to electrode needles. Stick one of those in my brain and it'll kick off a really bad seizure, and then total mind melt, lights out, that's all, folks. They call me Spaz, which is kind of a mope name, but I don't mind, not anymore. I'm talking into an old voice writer program that prints out my words because I was there when the bully bangers went to wheel the writer for his sins, and I saw what they saw, and I heard what they heard, and it kind of turned my brain around. The bangers have the latch on my part of the herb, which means they control everybody and everything between Eastie and the pipe. 1,000,000 people, maybe more. Nobody really knows how many, because nobody can count that high. Why bother? All you gotta know is, if you live here, you're either down with the bangers, or you might as well be dead. There's no escape, because every part of the herb is latched by one gang or another. The only escape is Eden, and you can't get in there unless you're approved. And if you're genetically improved, you'd never leave in the first place, so forget about Eden. I used to belong to a family unit, with a foster mom and dad and my little sister Bean, but that's over, and I don't want to talk about what happened or how unfair it was. Not yet. The less said about that, the better. Because if there's one thing I learned from Ryder, it's that you can't always be looking backward or something will hit you from the front. Ryder was this gummy that changed my life. And if you're reading this, maybe you changed the world too. Gummies are what we call old people. And the Ryder was so ancient, the hair on his chin beard was as white as bone. And most of his teeth were gone. Even his skin was old and worn out and so thin, it looked like if you held him up to the light, you'd see right through him. The way I got to know Ryder is this. The banger sent me to bust him down. As far as I was concerned at the time, he was just another gummy scheduled for cancellation, so why not rip him off? And that's exactly what I did. Chapter 2. Stealing is my job. The stack box where Ryder lives is out at the edge, alongside of the pipe. The pipe is broken now, but in the back times, they say it carried billions of gallons of water into the herb, fresh, clean water that didn't have to be boiled and filtered before you drank it, water so pure you could swim in it without shriveling. I figure that's a made-up story, like a lot of the back-timer talk. In case you don't know, the back times were before the big shake, when everything supposedly was perfect and everybody lived rich. Personally, I doubt the back times ever existed. It's like a story you tell to make yourself feel better, that's all. The kind of story that starts with my real mom is a rich prove and my real dad is a latch boss and someday they'll rescue me and we'll all move to Eden and live happily ever after. Yeah, right. That only happens in the trendies. In real life, nobody comes to your rescue. Believe me, I know. Anyhow, the stacks. Nobody owns the stacks, and if you squat in one long enough, I guess you can call it home. If home is a little concrete box stacked 10 high in rows of 100. They say in the back times they used the boxes to store all the things they owned, but the only things stored there now are losers, assorted mopes and needle brains and gummies like the Ryder. You can smell the stacks before you see them, on account of there's no plumbing, and the boxers have to use the ground like animals. The strange thing is, at first glance, it looks like nobody lives there. Nearby is this old industrial warehouse that sort of caved in long ago, and the rusty beams and rubble are strewn around, which makes it hard to walk without tripping over stuff. I can hear the scratchy noise of rats scurrying out of my way, and when there's rats, the humans are sure to be close. But where are they? Hiding, it turns out. As I get closer, a small, smeary face peeks up from behind a pile of rubble, and then there's a whistle, a warning signal, and the noise of people scrambling to hide themselves like they're afraid of something. Me, probably. They assume I'm one of the bully bangers, come to bust them down or worse, which is pretty close to the truth even if I don't like to admit it. I'm not officially down with the bangers, but the gang boss, Billy Bismo, he sort of likes me for some reason. When he heard I lost my family unit, he said, make room for the spaz boy, and they did. So the deal is, I'm here to steal. Stealing is my job. It's how I stay alive. Either you pay tribute to the bangers, which means they get half of everything that sticks to your hands, or the bangers decide you're no longer among the living. Which makes things very simple, even if sometimes you feel sort of bad about ripping off people who are even poorer than you are. Steal or die, that's what it comes down to. Be a banger or be gone, as the saying goes. Anyhow, this little face pokes up again from the rubble and looks at me with big scared eyes, and I go, hey, don't move. And he freezes. The little face belongs to a little kid, maybe 5 years old, although he's got at least a million years worth of dirt on his cheeks. I bend down to look at him closer, and a tear cuts through the dirt, which makes me feel bad, even though I haven't hurt the little guy or ripped him off or anything. Not yet. Hey, I go, can you talk? Little face nods. Now there are two tears melting the dirt on his cheeks. Keeping my voice real low and gentle, I go, you want a chox bar? All you gotta do, show me the way to Ryder's stack box. You know where he lives? I take the chox bar from my pocket and unwrap it so he can see. But he looks even more scared. I break off half and give it to him and go, eat it. Come on, it ain't gonna kill ya. And he kind of flinches, and that's when I realize he's never had a chox bar, and he thinks it might be poison. I break off another little piece and put it in my mouth and go, mmm, good. And finally he eats a piece and waits for it to explode. When the taste starts to hit him, all velvety chocolate, little face finally stops crying. Told you it was good, I say. Now what about the geese they call Ryder? Where can I find him, huh? Little face walks me through the rows of stack boxes. He doesn't say anything. He's too busy sucking the taste out of the chox bar. Or maybe he's still too scared to talk. Whatever, when he gets to a certain row, he stops and just stands there. I go, is this it? Instead of saying yes, he runs away. One of the boxes on the lower row is open. Usually you have to bust down the door, which is why they call it a bust down, of course. But this place is wide open. Like the mope who lives there is saying, go ahead, rip me off. Which makes me think he could be waiting inside to cut my red and splash me. That's how you have to think, real cautious and paranoid, when you're on a bust down. Mostly the mopes don't dare fight back because of what the gang would do to them. But sometimes you get a suicidal mope, and then all bets are off. As it turns out, the mope is waiting inside, but he doesn't try to fight. He's this gummy with white, white hair and shiny eyes. That's the first thing I notice, how his eyes kind of light up from deep inside his head. He's wearing a loose, ragged tunic that's stitched together, made from even older rags, which means he's even poorer than most of the curb people. Hello, young man, he goes. Welcome to my humble abode. He's sitting behind this crummy old crate he uses as a desk, resting his chin on his hands and looking at me with those shiny old eyes, real casual, like he couldn't care less about getting ripped off. Humble abode must be backtimer talk for stack box or crud hole or whatever, but I'm not there to flapjaw with some gummy old mope. I just want to get in, take whatever junk he's hoarding, and get out. That's when I noticed that all his stuff is lined up by the door, ready to go. I've been expecting you, he explains. Word gets around out here in the stacks. You are, I assume, an emissary from the Bully Bangers? I nod. Come on in, he says. Make yourself at home. I go, huh? Like, what are you, twisted? You want to bust down? You want to get ripped? Are you brain sick or what? Except all I really say is, huh? Because the rest is implied, which is a word I later got from Ryder. I heard about the Bully Bangers giving me up, he says. Like it's no big deal. Bound to happen, sooner or later. Help yourself, son. Everything of value is over there by the door. He points out a tote bag with a few cruddy items inside. An old alarm clock vid screen, a streetball mitt so old it's made of molded plastic, a mini stove with a power cord all neat and coiled. It doesn't amount to much, but there's enough for a few credits at the pawn mart. Better than usual for the stacks. Go on, he says, urging me on, take it. Normally I would, but there's something not normal about the whole situation. Like the way he coiled up the cord to the mini stove. You know you're going to get ripped off, and you do that? Is it some kind of trick or what? It's like he knows what I'm thinking, because the next thing he says is, this isn't my first bust down. Just thought I'd make it easier for us both. Go on, take it. Take it home. Yeah, what else you got? I ask, closing in on the old geese. Because he must be hiding something. Everybody tries to hide something. He smiles at me, which makes his wrinkled old face sort of glow in a weird way. Like he wants an excuse to smile no matter what happens. What makes you think I've got anything else? He asks. That's when I see there's a pile of something under the crate, and he's been sitting there in front of it, hoping I wouldn't notice. What's this? I go. Nothing of value, he says, pretending to yawn. Just a book is all. And that's when I know he's lying. Chapter 3. Those Who Remember. I go, liar! Books are in libraries, or they used to be. The man called Ryder starts to say something and then he stops, like I've given him something important to think about. Interesting, he says. You're aware that the things called books used to be stored in libraries. That was long before you were born, so how did you know? I shrug and say, I heard is all, when I was a little kid, about how things used to be before the Sheikh. And you remember everything you hear? Pretty much, I say. Doesn't everybody? The old gummy chuckles. Not hardly. Most of them, they had their brains softened by needle probes, and they can't really retain much. Long-term memory is a thing of the past, no pun intended. The only ones left who can remember books are a few old geezers like me, and apparently you. Now that I think about it, I know what he's talking about. I've always had a lot of old stuff in my head that everybody else seems to have forgotten. What else do you remember? Ryder asks. What do you care? The gummy gives me a look like he wants to memorize me or something. Remembering things is very important to a writer. Before you can put it down on paper, you have to remember what happened. Put what down on paper? What are you spewing, huh? He takes a piece of paper from the pile of stuff he's trying to hide in the crate. The paper is covered with small black marks. I hold it up close to my eyes to see if there's anything hidden there inside the paper, but to me the marks look like the footprints of bugs. I used to use a voice writer like everybody else, but it got ripped off, Ryder explains. So I went back to basics. I write down each word by hand, like they did in the back times. Primitive, but it works. I go, but what's the point? What are you putting inside your book? Ryder looks at me for a while before he says, sorry, son, but that's between me and myself. I can tell you this much. My book is the work of a lifetime. You're wasting your time, I tell him. Nobody reads books anymore. Ryder nods sadly. I know. But someday that may change. And if and when it does, they'll want stories, experiences, that don't come out of a mind probe needle. People will want to read books again someday. They? I go. Who do you mean? Those who will be alive at some future date, he says. Those who will be alive at some future date. I don't know why, but the way he says it gives me a shiver, because I'd never thought about the future. You want to be down with the bangers? You can't think about the future. There's only room for the right here and the want it now. The future is like the moon. You never expect to go there or think about what it might be like. What's the point if you can't touch it or steal it or shoot it into your brain? What's your story, son? Ryder asks, like he really wants to know. I go, I don't have a story. Almost before I get the words out, he's shaking his head, like he knew what I was gonna say and can't wait to disagree. Everybody has a story, he insists. There are things about your life that are specific only to you, secret things you know. When he says secret things, a chill goes up from the base of my spine to the top of my head and makes my brain feel numb and frosty. Because there's certain things I can't stand to remember, and the last thing I want to do is share them with some old gummy. You're zoomed, I tell him, crazy as a cockroach, and I'm out of here. Before I go, he makes me take his stuff. The mini stove, the alarm clock, vidscreen, all his junk. You'll need this, he says. I know how it works with the gangs. So I take his crummy stuff. I rip the old geese off. I feel weird and sort of sick about it, but it doesn't matter because I'll never see him again. And if you can't see something, it doesn't really exist, right? Right? Chapter 4. The Girl with Sky-Colored Eyes. On the way back to my cube, I get sighted by a proof, which scares me halfway dead. I'm cutting through this old falling-down place they call the Maxi Mall, which used to be full of trade stalls in the back times. They say every stall was piled high with jewelry and fancy clothes and mysterious gizmos and lots of shiny things nobody really remembers anymore. They say there were stalls with 10,000 different kinds of chox bars instead of just the one. Probably that's a lie about the chox bars, but I'd like to believe it. There's still a few traders at the Maxi, but they're protected by bristle bars and cut wire, and the techs will beat you with stun sticks if you haven't got anything worth trading. I'm keeping my distance when a TACV pulls up to one of the stalls. TACV is slang for Tactical Urban Vehicle, the heavily armored, cyber-driven vans that proofs use to get around the herb. If you're paying attention, you already know a proof is a genetically improved human being. They're the people who own the world, or at least the part of it they call Eden. You can always tell a proof because they're all tall and beautiful and healthy-looking. The other way to tell a proof is how they look at you if you're a normal. A proof can't help shuddering inside when he sees a normal. We give them the creeps. We're a reminder of what human beings are like when they're not born perfect. And I guess if you're a proof, the very idea of imperfection makes you want to throw up. Anyhow, a bunch of techs, that's short for technical security guards, get out of the TACV. Six of them, all talking to each other on their implanted headsets. When they take up positions and give the all clear, the TACV doors fold down, and out comes this proof. A female dressed in a shimmering white gown that you can almost see through, but not quite. She's got beautiful gray sky-colored eyes and perfect skin and short hair that sort of glows like the sun is always shining on her. I'm staring at her. You can't help it with a proof. It makes me ache inside and feel scummy on the outside, like I should hide myself from her perfect eyes. But I don't hide. There's no place to go. And for some reason, she notices me. Her hand goes up to her face and she touches her perfect ear, communicating to the techs on her implant. I'm thinking, run, boy, they're gonna jolt you into a coma just for looking. But suddenly there's a tech close behind and I can't get away. Halt, he goes, and I do. Like most techs, he's wearing a protective face mask, so I can't see his expression. Is he going to jolt me with his stun stick or what? I'm bracing myself for the buzz and hoping it won't set off spasms when he goes, follow me. What he does is, he takes me to the proof, which is like unheard of. A proof allowing a normal to approach. But that's what happens. And I can see the proof girl is young, maybe my age. Proofs don't wrinkle much because of their genetically improved skin, but you can still tell whether they're young or old if you get close enough. And this one is definitely young, maybe 14 or 15. And her teeth are white, not yellow like normal teeth. I wonder if all proofs have white teeth, so perfectly white. Do you have a name? She asks me. I want to say, what do you think, just because we're not perfect, we don't have names? But all I can manage to get out of my choked-up throat is, Spaz. Spaz, she says, like she's tasting it on her tongue and isn't sure if she likes it. How odd. All of you seem to have such strange and interesting names down here in the Latches. Then she points to one of the techs and goes, provide for him. And just like that, she turns away and strides into the trade stall as if she's already forgotten that I exist. Another tech pokes me in the back with a stun stick. The charge is set low so it doesn't knock me down or anything. Stop staring, you, he orders me. Your eyes are dirty. There's nothing wrong with my eyes, but I do what he asks and stop looking at the beautiful Prove while she goes trading. And the tech hands me a small plastic bag with edibles inside. Protein bars and carbo shakes and chocs bars and stuff like that. The way he does it makes me think the Prove girl does this all the time. Hands out goodies to normals to make herself feel even more perfect than she already is. I should hate her for that, for the way she feels, but I don't. I can't. You can't hate a Prove when you're near one, because you want to be like them. You ache to be like them. You want to be perfect too, and you know if you were improved, you'd act just like they do and feel what they feel and glide through the world with sky-colored eyes and hair like sunlight, and nothing dirty or broken could ever touch you. Then when you've had your little adventure in the big, bad, dangerous herb, you'd go home to Eden and live happily ever after. Me, I go home to the crypts. My cube is small and dingy, with a chunk of foam on the floor. Not a real bed, but it's way better than not having a place to sleep or just hang, even if the door doesn't lock from the inside. That's a rule in the crypts. No door locks, because the bangers want to be able to enter anytime they feel like it. They take what they want, too, but for some reason they let me keep an old 3D, which is better than nothing. Nobody but me cares about watching 3Ds anymore, because why waste your time with a crummy hologram movie when you can boot up one of the brand new mind probes and see the whole show inside your head, like you were really there? Anyhow, I toss the gummy stuff in the corner and turn on the machine and start watching this 3D I've seen like 10,000 times, the one where Coley Riggins has to fight his way across the solar system, planet by planet, to rescue this gorgeous female who thinks he's dead, so she's gonna marry this other guy, which would be a big mistake because the other guy is the one who keeps trying to kill poor Coley. You've probably seen it if they still have the old 3Ds when you read this. If not, trust me, it's a really cool story. And usually I can get right into it and have fun pretending I'm as big and strong and good-looking as Coley Riggins, but today I can't concentrate on it. Instead, I keep thinking about the old geese and what he said about those who will be alive at some future date. For some reason, the idea of future gets inside my head and won't let go. Future. That's like a time that doesn't exist yet. A world full of people who haven't been born yet. Doing things that nobody's thought of yet. Also, I keep flashing on the Prove girl with the sky-colored eyes. Like somehow she's all mixed up with what happened in the stacks. Even though I know she doesn't have any connection to the old gummy they call Ryder. I eat some of the stuff the Prove girl gave me, which is better than the tasteless protein chunks you get from a food shoot. But I can't stop thinking about Ryder and how he said, there are things about your life that are specific only to you. Secret things. What I don't understand is, how did he know? Does it have anything to do with that pile of scratch marks he called a book? There's one thing I do know. Sooner or later, I'll have to go back to the stacks and find out. Chapter 5. Three Rules for Billy Bismo. I'm sound asleep when the bully bangers invade my cube. Spaz! Spaz boy, wake up! The bangers are kicking through my stuff, checking out the goodies. One of them is pawing the edibles the Prove girl gave me when Billy Bismo smacks him. Leave it, Billy says, grinning at me. You with us, Baz boy? You with us or against us? I'm with you, I say, trying to get my brain in gear. I've been deep inside this crazy, confusing dream about Coley Riggins rescuing the Prove girl. Or maybe the Prove girl was rescuing him. Doesn't matter. What matters is paying attention to Billy Bismo, because you never know what Billy is really thinking. And that's just one of about 1,000 different things that make him dangerous. Billy with his sharp, crooked nose and curly hair like tufts of rusty iron. and his ratty yellow teeth and the pale scars on his neck and jaw where somebody tried to kill him once and missed. Somebody no longer among the living, guaranteed. "This junk come from the stacks?" he asks me, even though he already knows the answer. "That's all he had, the one they call Ryder? You're sure he's not hiding nothing rich, nothing special?" "He's just an old gummy," I say. "That's all he had." I can't believe I'm lying to Billy Bismo, boss man of the bangers. What do I care about the old man or his stupid pile of papers? But it's too late to take back the lie. And anyhow, Billy seems more interested in the edibles. "Explain," he says, holding up a carbo shake. So I tell him about the Proof girl. How she came to the Maxi with her techs and told them to provide for me. "Provide for you?" Billy says, fingering the scars on his neck as he mulls it over. "Why you, boy? Why you in particular?" I shrug. I was there, I guess. "You mean this Proof girl was looking for a charity case?" "I don't know what a charity case is, Billy." "Never mind. What'd you say to her? Tell me exactly what you said." "She asked me what they call me. I told her." "That's it? Your name?" "That's it." Billy crouches so he can study my eyes and see if I'm lying. That always makes me feel like I'm lying even when I'm telling the truth, which I am about the Proof girl. The thing that makes Billy scary isn't his size, because he's not that much bigger than me. It's in his eyes. Sometimes his eyes are bright and interested, and that makes you want to please him. And then he blinks. And his eyes are dead, and you're scared he wants to make you dead, too, just for the cool of it, just because he can. He goes. "I've heard about this Proof girl. She's a slummer. You know what a slummer is, Spaz? Huh?" "No," I admit. "A slummer is a Proof who likes to mix with the rest of us, gives them a thrill they can't find in Eden. You know what happens to a normal who gets mixed up with a Proof if the rest of the Proofs find out?" "No." Billy makes a slicing sign across his throat. The idea seems to amuse him. "Forbidden, Spaz boy. They'll splash you. They'll cut your red. They'll blow you into particles, so keep away from the Proof girl. You see her again? Run like your life depends on it. Because it does. Do you believe me?" "Yes." "Good boy. Always believe Billy. That's rule number one. And what's rule number two?" "Always obey Billy," I say. "Excellent. Third rule? Always speak true to Billy." "Fantastic." He's acting delighted with me, but I don't know if it's for real or a game he's playing. "Not bad for a Spaz boy. Keep it up, kid. Follow Billy's rules, and you may live to be as old as that gummy you ripped off." He hands me the Proof girl's carbo shake. "Go on," he says. "Enjoy, have a taste of Eden." A moment later, they're gone and I'm alone in my cube. For some reason, I'm shaking. No, not for some reason, because I lied to Billy Bismo. I broke his rules. If he finds out, he might decide to have me canceled. Or he might decide to let me live, but ban me from the Crips. Disfavor, they call it, which means you're on the curb, fending for yourself without protection or shelter. Death or disfavor. I don't know which is worse, and I don't want to find out. Chapter 6. The Thing About Bean. Later that day, I go back to the stacks. My plan is I'll finish ripping off the old gummy and take his worthless papers, the junk he calls a book, and give it to Billy Bismo like I should have done in the first place. That's my plan. But in the end, it doesn't work out that way. This time, Littleface pops up as soon as he sees me coming. "Chalkspar," he chirps, holding out his dirt-colored hands. "You know any other words, huh?" He shakes his head. "Chalks, chalks." I get one out of my pouch and give it to him, and he gulps it down and holds out his hands again. "You know the way," I tell him. "Take me to Ryder, then you get another chalkspar." So Littleface guides me through the rows of stack boxes like before, only this time the old gummy is standing in the door waiting for me. "Don't be surprised," he says with a smile. "Bad news travels fast in this part of the world." I don't know why, but that hits me hard, the idea that I'm bad news. Of course, it's true. Me coming back to the stacks is bad news. What else could it be? But he looks so hopeful, like he's sure I'll prove him wrong, that my plan to rip him off again goes right out the back of my head. Not today, I'm thinking. I'll steal his stupid book some other day. Come on in, Ryder says, stepping to one side. Make yourself at home. He's got this look in his watery old gray eyes, like he knows something I don't. But for some reason, that doesn't make me mad. It just makes me want to know, too. But what? What is it he knows? He sees the look on my face and goes, something happened. Is it the bangers? Have they canceled me? I shake my head. Not yet. Not yet, he says, sounding real thoughtful. Thank you for being honest with me. If you'd said nothing to worry about, I'd know it wasn't the truth. And I always want to know the truth. Right, I'm thinking, just like Billy Bismo. Inside it's cool and shadowy, and of course there's no furniture, so I sit on the floor with my legs crossed. The old geese sits on the crate box he uses for a desk. The way light comes in, I can't see his face, and his baggy old one-piece makes him look thin and shapeless at the same time, like he's lost inside his clothes. I've been thinking about you, Ryder says, about your story. I told you, I say, I don't have a story. His head turns, and now I can see his eyes, how big and old and kind they are. What you're really saying is you don't have a story worth telling, he says. Let me be the judge of that. I want to stand up and shout that he's got no right to tell me what I really mean, what makes him think he knows so much, but instead I sit there and keep my mouth shut. Maybe because underneath it all, I know what he says is true. Start at the beginning, he suggests. What's the first thing you remember? The first thing. That's easy. The first thing is when I got my little sister, Bean. The thing about Bean is, she isn't really my sister. We're not blood. But I didn't know that then, because I didn't know that Kay and Charlie weren't my real mother and father. All that came later when I started to grow. But when Bean came along, I was maybe 4 years old, and that's the first thing I remember. This tiny, widgy little face wrapped in a soft blanket. Her squinty eyes and her tiny little lips all smooched up like she'd been sucking a lemon. How she smelled like warm milk. Baby stuff. She was only a few days old, okay? But what I really remember is what happened when she saw me staring down at her. Her whole face smiled, and her little hand came up and tried to grab my nose, and that was it. I loved Bean right from that moment, and it never changed. No matter what happened, all the bad things later, and me losing my family unit because of her, it never made me love Bean any less. So you were a foundling, Ryder says, and Bean is your adoptive sister. Foundling? An old word, he says, but useful. Like you were found on the curb and taken in. Do you have any knowledge of your origins, your birth mother, father? I shrug like who cares, because it doesn't matter. Nobody wants to claim a spaz boy, that's for sure. Never mind that part for now, Ryder says. Tell me more about your sister. Tell me about Bean. The thing that's really important to understand about Bean is that she only sees the good in people, never the bad. Because my foster dad, I suppose he's basically okay, but he's got this bad side, too. And Bean never saw it, like she'd erased the idea of bad from her mind. So when everything blew up and Charlie, that's his name, Charlie, so when everything blew and Charlie got it fixed in his head that I was growing up dangerous and that somehow Bean might get infected with whatever it was that made me a spaz, Bean never saw it coming. When Charlie finally told me I had to leave, that he was banning me from the family unit, Bean tried to hug me and tell me it couldn't be true. He didn't mean it. Big mistake. Because Charlie pulled her off me and smacked her right in the face and called her terrible names. Names she didn't even understand. Names no one should ever have to hear. What did Charlie think? Ryder wants to know. Did he think you and Bean were love mates? I don't know what he thought, I say. I'd never touch Bean that way, not ever. Even if she isn't blood, she's still my little sister. Ryder watches me for a while like he's waiting for something to happen, for me to react, maybe. And then when I don't say anything more, he goes, I wish I could say I'm surprised by your foster father's reaction. But the prejudice against epileptics is as old as the human race. Do you know the story of Alexander the Great? I shake my head. Remarkable man, Ryder says. He conquered the world a long, long time ago. Yeah, I go, so? He had epilepsy too. Many great humans have been epileptic. It's as if the brain compensates by increasing intelligence and ambition. Yeah, right. The epilepsy is part of what made you, he says. Don't hate it. Don't hate the spaz? Is he serious? The spaz is why I lost my family unit, why I can never see Bean again, why people run away when it happens. Spaz isn't just a name, it's a warning. Look out for the spaz boy, he might have a fit and bite you. He'll infect you, he'll infect your unborn children. Cast him out, banish him, disfavor him. Cancel him, they sometimes whisper. The boy is a monster, a mistake. He never should have been born. But Ryder, he doesn't get it. You think of it as a curse, he says, but the curse is also a blessing. If you didn't have it, you'd be sticking needles in your brain like all the others. Rotting your mind with probes. Living in a mind probe instead of real life. You'd have trouble remembering what happened last week, never mind when you were 4 years old. You'd have forgotten all about your sister. Shut up, I say, holding my hands to my ears. Shut up. But the stupid gummy won't shut up. He's trying to tell me something important, even though I'm covering my ears and I don't want to hear it, and I don't want to think about who I am or what's wrong with me or why I'm out here on the edge of the herb, at the edge of the known world, listening to some old mope who's so crazy thinks about the future when everyone knows that the future doesn't exist. Shut up, I scream, shut up! And then I'm running away, running as fast as my feet will take me, running until I can't hear him anymore, and the only word in my head is the word that never leaves, the word I hate the most, the word that means me. Spaz, spaz, spaz. Chapter 7. All news is bad news. When I finally slow down, I'm a long way from the stacks, in a part of the herb I've never been before, where the streets are narrow and dark, and the buildings are so high the sky disappears, and it might as well be night, even in the daytime. A place like this, you stick to the shadows and try not to be seen, because if they don't know you, the locals will assume you're enemy, and most of the time they're right. A drum fire burns on each street corner, and I can see the enforcers warming their hands in the sooty orange flames. They're the block guardians, armed with shetty blades and probably splat guns, too. They might know I'm almost down with the bangers, and they might not. They might cut my red, and they might not. The might part will kill you. So I edge my way along, trying to blend into the concrete. I'm thinking, you mope, never go where you're not known. It's my own fault, but I want to blame it on Ryder for telling me things I don't want to hear. This time I'm lucky. Nobody sees me. I creep away through the alleys, keeping to the darkest shadows, heart pounding so hard my ears hurt, barely breathing, moving as quiet as a whisper, thinking, please let me get away. If I get away this time, I'll never be stupid again. After what seems like forever, I finally get to a place where I know the streets and they know me. I made it this time. Back at the crypts, I'm ready to fall down on my foam and sleep, because being afraid makes you tired. But I never make it to the foam because someone is waiting inside my cube. As soon as I step through the door, a voice hisses, "Don't move!" I can't see who it is because the power is out again, but the voice in the dark sounds as scared as me. "Who is it?" I ask. "Nobody," whispers the voice. "A runner." A runner. Runners carry messages between the latches, crossing from one gang area to the next, and they're strictly forbidden. The gangs want to control everything, and that includes information. Because it's so dangerous, get caught and you're canceled, latch runners are highly paid, and that's what bothers me. I don't know anyone who could afford to send me a message by runner, or anyone who'd want to, even if they could. "Shut the door," the voice urges me. I shut the door. The darkness is close and thick and makes me feel out of breath all over again. "Show me your face," I demand, trying to sound brave. "Never," says the voice. "Listen and listen well. I'm not here. We never met, understood? All I am is a message." "What message?" The runner's voice changes slightly as he recites what he was sent to tell me. I bring you news of home, he begins. Already my heart is sinking because nobody knows better than me that all news is bad news, and this is the worst news there ever was. Your sister lies close to death, the runner tells me. She wishes to see you one last time. End of message. That's all. A moment later, the door eases shut and I'm alone in my crib in the dark. I find my old microflash and turn it on, but the light doesn't help. Nothing helps. The words are like a scream inside my head that won't stop echoing. Bean is dying and she wants to see me. That's two impossible things. Bean can't be dying, and I can't see her because my old family unit lives on the other side of the herb. That's why I was banished to Billy Bismo's latch, so there'd be some distance between us. Now if I want to get to Bean, and I do more than anything, I'll have to go through at least three warring latches that won't let a stranger pass. Unless... Billy Bismo, I say to myself, and the name gives me hope. Hope to see Bean, hope to save her somehow. Billy might grant me safe passage. He has the power if he wants to make it happen. Maybe he can even fix whatever it is that's wrong with Bean. I'm not thinking too clear. There's no room for anything inside my brain but what to do about Bean. Or else I might have remembered another of Billy's rules, the rule that you never go to him. He has to come to you. Because when I get to the bottom level of the crypts, where the bangers have their headquarters, the enforcers throw me down on the damp concrete. Search him, I hear someone say, and rough hands go over every inch of me looking for weapons. He's clean. They flip me over so I'm looking up into their laser sights. State your purpose, scum. Billy, I gasp, closing my eyes so the lasers don't burn me. Need to see Billy. Billy don't need to see you. It's the spaz boy, one of them says. Must be having a fit to come down here without an invite. Crazy mope, let's cut him. I figure they'll do it. They'll cut me for sure, but for some reason they hold off. Now they're mumbling to each other, but I can't make out the words. Do it, somebody says. Go on, slam the little mope. Boots womp into my ribs so hard the air goes out of me and won't come back in. Move and you die. I'm making this can't-breathe noise, erp, erp, and it makes them laugh and go, listen to the spaz boy singing our song. I'm not thinking of anything except finding a way to make my lungs work. Finally, the air whistles into me and their steel-toed boots prod at me like I'm a bug that can't turn over, which is pretty close to the truth. Pick him up. They carry me into another room. A room where the light is dim and purple and the air smells of incense and candles and something like medicine. Billy Bismo's private crib. I don't care how much it hurt, I'm in. They drop me on a rug at his feet and tell me not to move, not to say a word, because the boss man is busy. He's got things on his mind. When my eyes adjust to the dim purple light, I see what they're talking about. The thing on Billy's mind is a needle. He's probing. That's the medicine smell, the disinfectant for the electrode needle that slips into his brain. The boss man of the bangers sits in a big padded chair, like the throne of a mighty king in the back times. His eyes are open, but you can tell he's not seeing the room, or the candles all around, or me. He's seeing whatever's happening inside his head, where the mind probe is playing, putting him right there, like he's inside a moving hologram, only better. Better than real, better than anything. Not that I know from personal experience. Like I said at the beginning, a spaz like me can't probe. They say it's like entering another world, a world created for your pleasure and excitement, a world where all your dreams come true and every wish is granted. A world much, much better than the one we live in, that's for sure. If I could do it, I'd probe myself into a place where I still lived with my family unit, and we were all happy and healthy and loved each other forever and ever, like in Eden. But I can't probe. I can't wait until Billy comes out of it either,